It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Islamist insurgency forces Nigerian schools to close in Borno State. Washington trims some aid to Uganda over new anti-homosexual law. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Authorities in Nigeria's Borno State shuttered all public schools due to the threat posed by the militant group Boko Haram. Thousands have died in the violence over the past 4 years. Efforts by Nigeria's military to hunt down militants and halt the insurgency have so far failed to stop frequent large-scale attacks. An early Tuesday raid by militants in central Somalia killed 11 government and African Union soldiers, wounded nearly 20 others. Somali officials blame militant group Al-Shabaab for the attack in the town of Bulo Bird, which the Somali National Army, the African Union mission in Somalia, recaptured from Al-Shabaab just last week. The countries around Lake Chad in Central Africa have agreed to create a joint task force to combat arms trafficking, terrorism, and cross-border attacks. Moki Edwin Kinziger reports the conflict in Central African Republic and the Islamist insurgency in northern Nigeria are fueling regional tensions.
Defense and military chiefs from the six-member Lake Chad Basin Commission met in Cameroon Tuesday and gave a green light to a multinational military task force empowered to act against militant threats. Cameroon's defense minister, Edgar Aleme Bengo,
cette réunion devrait représenter...
He says this meeting was sort of a shock therapy for Lake Chad Basin member states to address how best to tackle growing threats and the growing security challenges. Cameroon has been hit particularly hard by the chaos in the CAR and the Boko Haram attacks in northern Nigeria. Refugees from both countries have streamed into Cameroon, while officials have denied allegations that militants are using Cameroonian territory as a refuge or a base for operations. Chad, Cameroon, Libya, Niger, Nigeria, and the CAR agreed that the initial mandate of the new task force will be to patrol the Lake Chad region, conduct military operations against arms dealers and suspected terrorists, and to facilitate free movement. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaounde.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has reportedly agreed to meet with an American delegation to discuss the country's new anti-homosexual law. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Washington wants to engage Mr. Museveni in dialogue on what the law is not based on science or fact. The law has been criticized by Western countries. The United States is reviewing its own assistance to Kampala. Tuesday, U.S. spokesperson Jen Psaki said an end to the program of topping off salaries of 18 health officials in Uganda was a first step.
We're taking a thoughtful, deliberate look at next steps in light of enactment of the law. So some of those pieces are how to send the strongest message, specifically the topping off of the salaries of these health officials is one way. But we've also been in touch and have been for some time with Ugandan LGBT activists since this legislation was actually first introduced in 2009. They've specifically asked that the United States not cut off aid to the Ugandan people.
USAID includes funding of medicines to fight HIV/AIDS and efforts to bring members of the Lord's Resistance Army to justice. Kenyan police arrested two men suspected of links to the Somali group Al-Shabaab in the port city of Mombasa. County Commissioner Nelson Marwa said their vehicle contained automatic weapons and explosives.
It was not just a normal vehicle. The vehicle was carrying 7.62 millimeters rounds of ammunition, 270 of them, 6 cylinders of explosives, 6, not 2. In the morning, we had not gone through the vehicle thoroughly. Now we can confirm to you 6 cylinders of powerful explosives.
Al-Shabaab has claimed attacks in Kenya following Nairobi's intervention in the Somali conflict. Last September, nearly 70 were killed in a militant attack on Nairobi's Westgate Mall. Libyan rebel leader Ibrahim Gidron denounced the U.S. military seizure Sunday of a North Korean-flagged vessel laden with crude oil from the rebel-held port of Asidra. The Morning Glory loaded with the oil in defiance of Tripoli, which requested U.S. assistance in gaining control of the vessel. Senior U.N. official John Ging warned Tuesday the number of people in Sudan in need of assistance has risen nearly 40% over the past year, boosted by recent fighting in western Darfur region. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. More can be found at our internet website, that address, voanews.com.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The World Food Program says it will cut food rations for millions in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
We will have to scale down all those programs, long-term program, in-depth program, because of the lack of funding.
Elizabeth Byers is the spokesperson for the World Food Program. South Sudan's president increases his cabinet. A Kenyan lawmaker praises an American education program. Zimbabwe imposes a salary cap for all senior managers of state enterprises. And claims and counterclaims of political violence as Malawi prepares for presidential election.
I don't think the president is capable of saying that he will investigate the violence. Because, as I'm talking, yesterday, last night, we were severely beaten by DPP staff.
Nicola Diosi is the National Publicity Secretary for the Opposition Democratic Progressive Party of Malawi. And we have a profile of the judge in the trial of Oscar Pistorius. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The World Food Program says it will fall far short of its goal of feeding 4 million people in the Democratic Republic of Congo this year because of a severe funding shortage. The WFP warns it will have to drastically cut its current programs unless international donors respond to its appeal. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The World Food Program has been low on cash for some time. Last year, it cut food rations across the board for all its beneficiaries in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It also scaled back some other activities in hopes of salvaging most of its humanitarian operation. But this has not worked. WFP says it expects to run out of food next month in most of the country. Spokeswoman Elizabeth Beers tells VOA her agency will be forced to discontinue food aid except in the areas of greatest suffering.
This is an heartbreaking decision, but without funding, we cannot buy the food. We cannot buy the 3,000 tons of specialized nutritional product for babies. We need 15,000 metric tons of food in the next 6 months to provide assistance in form of our cash and voucher program. So we will have to scale down all those program, long-term program, in-depth program, because of the lack of funding.
The WFP appealed for $478 million to pay for humanitarian assistance in the DRC between July 2013 and December 2015. To date, it has received only 26% of this request. The agency says it urgently needs $48 million to carry through its operations until August. Currently, WFP is feeding 1.5 million people every month in DRC. It says it plans to increase that number to 2.2 million people this year, but that is nowhere near the 4.2 million people it had hoped to reach. Because it is cash poor, Beer says WFP will now focus its aid operations on the most vulnerable people.
Those who suffer the most and the most are in need of life-saving assistance. And we will cut and ration, and we will also scale down our school meal program and focus only on those, on the children, for instance, who need the most urgent assistance, the most life-saving assistance.
The narrowed feeding programs will target those who are internally displaced by conflict in Congo's eastern provinces, including Katanga, Oriental, and North and South Kivu, and the thousands of refugees from Central African Republic. Most of the 63,000 refugees are in northwestern Equateur province. Half of them are living in camps and are supported by WFP. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
President Salva Kiir of South Sudan has ordered the creation of 6 new cabinet posts, increasing the number from 21 to 27 after cutting back the number of ministries less than a year ago. Charlton Doki of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Kampala.
The new ministries are Veterans Affairs, Trade, Industry and Investment, Labor, Tourism and Wildlife Conservation, Livestock and Fisheries, and finally Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Management. Last August, President Kiir introduced a streamlined cabinet after firing every single minister, with the exception of Barnaba Marial Benjamin, who switched from being Information Minister to Minister of Foreign Affairs in late July. During that reshuffle, Mr. Kiir reduced the number of ministries from 29 to 21, saying he was responding to calls for a leaner government in order to save public funds. Foreign Affairs Ministry spokesman Mawian McCall Arik says now that the country is again exporting oil and austerity measures have been lifted, the government has the money to spend on additional ministries. And McCall says the new government will be more inclusive.
We need an inclusive government where the other political parties can also participate. And you remember the other time it was because of the austerity measures that the government had to go lean. But now things have changed and there is a need for an inclusive government. So that's why the government had to expand.
Last November, Finance Minister Agretisa Saboni said the government did not have enough money to pay many of its civil servants as it was trying to pay back $5 billion in unfavorable loans it took on while oil production was shut down for more than a year. President Kiir has yet to appoint ministers who will head the six new ministries. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki.
With exactly 2 months before Malawi's May 20th presidential and parliamentary elections, both the opposition and President Joyce Banda's ruling People's Party are trading accusations of electoral violence. On Monday, President Banda called for a thorough investigation into violent clashes between opposition protesters and police, which led to the death of two people. Information Minister Brown Umpangangira says the opposition Democratic Progressive Party is behind the violence, which took place Sunday while President Banda was campaigning in an opposition stronghold.
We cannot be told where to go and where not to go to hold our rallies. Secondly, President Joyce Banda is president of the whole Republic of Malawi. You cannot start limiting her to which areas she may or may not go. If they are suggesting that by going to the home of the leader of DPP, then we have provoked them. That's very sad because they too are free to go everywhere in the country. In fact, only a few days ago they had a meeting near the home of the president and they had a peaceful meeting. Nobody stopped them.
Brown Umpangangira is Malawi's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Nicholas Dawsey, the National Publicity Secretary for the opposition Democratic Progressive Party of Malawi, tells me President Joyce Banda's supporters are using violence because they know that the president will lose the May 20th election.
I don't think the president is capable of saying that he will investigate the violence. Because as I'm talking yesterday, last night, we were severely beaten by DPP subs. And the general killed my friend Ben Siri, who cannot talk right now. He's admitted at my Watu hospital.
The president, Joyce Banda, says that the government will not tolerate such acts of violence. And she claims they are intended to destabilize Malawi.
That is not true. The people from the ruling party are the ones that are perpetrating violence. I'm telling you what happened last night. The secretary of the party was there at Mount Swash Hotel when they were beating us, when they beat Ben. Right now, the man cannot talk. So the president cannot tell you in the United States, I said there is peaceful. The president is the one encouraging violence because his secretary, Mr. Maurito, was there, and it was done by the director of Youth for People's Party. So there's no way she can talk about peace. She's the one preaching violence, anarchy, destruction.
This is a very heavy political season. How is your party doing in the campaign?
DPP is strong, and let me tell you, come tomorrow, we are the ones forming the government come 20 May. We are the ones that are going to be voted in power. And by the way, People's Party is losing credit, is losing moral high ground by beating people, by creating anarchy, antagonism. In Malawi now, it's mafia style. It's rough house, cut throat, political antagonism.
You think that your party is going to be elected. Why?
We are going to win, Bwana. We have a mammoth, huge, tumultuous support. Unprecedented.
Your party was recently, a couple of years ago, in power. Why do you think the people of Malawi should elect your party again?
We had infrastructure development, food security we achieved. We have built secondary schools, university. So our track record is impeccable.
Nicola Dioceid is the National Publicity Secretary for the Opposition Democratic Progressive Party of Malawi. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. It's Wednesday morning, March 19th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. A Kenyan lawmaker has welcomed the impact of the Ford Foundation's International Fellowship Program on developing countries. Senator Agnes Zani, who is a former fellow of the U.S.-based program, says the program equipped her to be a better lawmaker. Zani is among seven other lawmakers who participated in the IFP program. In an interview with reporter Peter Clarty, Zani underscored its impact on her and her fellow legislators.
IFP opened up a wealth of opportunities for disadvantaged members of communities who would never have had the chance to advance, one, their educational pursuits, two, their social skills, and three, leadership abilities. Not only was it an academic program, but it was a social program that targeted social justice and helped us to build what we initially already had started in communities and take it to a different level. IFP was very careful, one, to ensure that we went in the direction we wanted to go by initially first finding out what areas of interest we had, so they did not impose. My passion, for example, is education of the girl child from marginalized, and I was able to work on a thesis that enabled me to delve further into areas of inequalities and come back a more confident young person with honed up leadership skills. And I'm happy that these leadership skills were discovered at a national level when I was nominated to be a member in the Senate.
Among your other colleagues, how has the program equipped you to better serve your community in the legislative arm of government in Kenya?
It has helped us because, one, it has enabled us to go into areas of training that were very specific for the various activities that we wanted to have. So we were not targeted. We were not told, for example, that you have to go and study in this specific place, in this specific degree. Everybody had a chance to go for the areas that they were best suited for them. And therefore, by going into those areas and having the passion to study in those areas already entailed from the word go, that they were well equipped in terms of interest and stamina and enthusiasm and being able to fulfill those specific roles.
What would you say has been the benefit of the people that are in your various communities based on the experiences that you've had from the IFP as well as your legislative experience?
They've benefited because, one, because we come from those communities, we're able to interpret and understand issues at a level that they can also understand. For example, one of the projects that we had was to ensure from the word go that we are able to make people understand what the new constitution is all about.
Agnes Zani is a Kenyan senator. She spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Nairobi. In Zimbabwe, President Robert Mugabe's cabinet on Tuesday approved a salary cap for all senior managers of state enterprises and local authorities amid public outcry over the huge salaries that some executives are earning. As Thomas Chiripasi reports from Harare, Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa had described such high salaries as illegal.
Minister Chinamasa told a news conference at Munumutapa building following the cabinet meeting today that cabinet resolved that no one in parastatals and municipalities countrywide should earn a maximum of $6,000, including all benefits such as health insurance, among other benefits. Chinamasa said the directive is with immediate effect. Chinamasa added that cabinet resolved that all government workers should earn salaries that are above the poverty datum line, although he did not say whether the government will be able to deliver on its promises this month. The finance minister was quoted in the media recently as saying that government will effect a pay rise in April, while President Robert Mugabe, who has said that he also wants a salary increment, has urged Minister Chinamasa to deliver on his promise. It is still unclear how Treasury will finance the increased salary bill, as Minister Chinamasa says government coffers are empty, with some returns from diamond sales yet to be accounted for. Some labor organizations, such as the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions and teacher organizations, have always called on authorities to increase workers' salaries, but government has always claimed that its purse is empty. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
She talks softly but carries a big stick. Judge Thokozile Masipa is a central figure in Oscar Pistorius' murder trial in South Africa. She has made a name for herself for being only the second black woman to ascend to the bench and for then using the position to fight South Africa's scourge of domestic violence. From the courtroom in Pretoria, viewers Anita Powell has more on South Africa's most famous judge.
When South Africa's prosecuting authority announced who would judge athlete Oscar Pistorius, local newspapers were quick to note the intriguing plot twist created by this addition to the cast of characters. Here's constitutional scholar Pierre Defosse, who teaches law at the University of Cape Town.
One always hopes to think that the choice of a judge won't make any difference to the trial. I would suspect that Mr. Pistorius and his lawyers are not overjoyed by the choice.
Judge Thokozile Masipa is black and a woman. The prosecuting authority was quick to note that she was not chosen to lead this case for those qualities, but rather because she is a competent and respected judge who happened to come up on the court roster. More relevantly to this trial, she also has a record of coming down hard on cases in which men are accused of abusing or killing women. She is now at the center of a case that has broken legal barriers by being the first South African criminal trial to be broadcast live. But being on the forefront is not new for Masipa. She was on the leading edge of a wave of judges and magistrates who transformed South Africa's judiciary from a nearly all-white boys' club in 1994, when 160 of 165 judges were white men, to a much more representative roster today. She joined the bench in 1998 and was only the second black woman to do so. Last year, the Department of Justice said the judiciary is now dominated by black male judges, 100, compared to 71 white men. 49 black women are seated judges, along with 21 white women. Those who have met Masipa describe her as smart, humble, and hardworking. Like Pistorius, she grew up with serious obstacles in her path to success. But while Pistorius's tale is one of triumph over disability, Masipa's is one of a victory over a system that was fundamentally stacked against her. Born in 1947, she grew up in Johannesburg's Soweto and Alexandra townships, areas designated for blacks during the apartheid era. She was smart, but struggled to find jobs as a social worker because of her race. After foundering in odd jobs, she became a journalist in the late 1970s and rose to editor despite saying she was too shy to be an effective journalist. So she began studying law at night while working a day job and caring for her two children. Those first years were not easy, she told a film crew that interviewed her several years ago. She began working in apartheid's twilight years and says her race and gender worked against her. The scars left by that tough journey are hidden well beneath her flowing red and black robes. But in recent years, she has shown a tendency to use the bench to come down hard on South Africa's out-of-control epidemic of domestic abuse. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria, South Africa.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. It was a day of mixed fortunes for Africa at the FIFA Women's Under-17 World Cup in Costa Rica on Tuesday. A first-half goal scored by defender Gladys Amphibia handed bronze medalists Ghana a 1-0 victory over Germany in Liberia. Ghana's second victory in the group stage guarantees them a place in the second round with a game in hand. Elsewhere in the capital San Jose, tournament debutants Zambia lost 4-0 to Venezuela, their second loss in as many matches. They are out of contention for a place in the second round. Meanwhile, Nigeria play Colombia in Alajuela in their second group match today, Wednesday. Nigeria won their opening match, so victory against Colombia will see them join Ghana in the knockout phase of the contest. In Benin, Frenchman Didier Ole-Nicole is the new coach for the Benin national team, the Benin Football Federation disclosed in Cotonou on Tuesday. His first order of business is to guide Benin in the qualifiers for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations. Turning to handball, defending champions Egypt play Tunisia as Angola and Algeria face off in the semifinals of the Africa Boys Youth Handball Championships in Nairobi, Kenya today, Wednesday. Kenya play Libya as Zambia face Niger in classification matches. The contest is a qualifier for the World Youth Olympics in Nanjing, China in August. Angola already qualified for Nanjing in the girls' event in Oyo, Congo-Brazzaville last year. Meanwhile, 24 teams have converged in Mahdia, a coastal town 225 kilometers southeast of the Tunisian capital Tunis, for the Arab Club Handball Championships starting today, Wednesday. Tunisia's Club Africains and Algeria's GS Petrolia are the defending champions in the men's and women's contests, respectively. Finally, in athletics, Kenya's First Lady Margaret Kenyatta resumes training at the world-famous High Altitude Training Center in Iten, North Rift Valley Province in western Kenya, today, Wednesday. Kenyatta aims to use her London Marathon appearance on the 13th of April to raise funds for maternity health care in Kenya's 47 counties. A fortnight ago, she completed the inaugural First Ladies Half Marathon in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Kenyatta and Rachel Ruto, the vice president's wife, are trained by former world marathon champion Douglas Wakihuri. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omen, Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, March 19th.
It still baffles me that in 2008, we lost 20 young Nigerians that are trying to actually gain employment through the Nigerian Immigration Service. 6 years later, we are losing another 19 set of young people. What is the Nigerian government doing about employment opportunities for the young people? It baffles me that people are not really talking. The Minister for Internal Affairs, Abamoro, is still there, has not resigned. And even the Controller General of Immigration is still there. Something must be done. Head must roll. This is Ayodele Olujide Oke. I call from Ibadan, Nigeria. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. An overnight raid by militants in central Somalia has killed 11 government and African Union soldiers and wounded at least 18 others. Somali officials blamed militant group Al-Shabaab for the attack in the town of Bulubodi, which the Somali National Army and the African Union mission in Somalia recaptured from Al-Shabaab last week. AMISOM spokesman Colonel Ali Hamoud tells VOA Somali service a man drove a car past a hotel checkpoint around 2:20 a.m. local time. The attack triggered a heavy gun battle at the hotel, which is used by Somali and AMISOM officials. And Kenyan police have arrested two men they say had explosives that were to be used in an attack. That's it for this Wednesday, March 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I am James Barty in Washington, wishing everybody in Africa a very nice day. Stay tuned for International Edition.
Love African music?
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.